And now we have Randall Forsberg. She is, I believe, in many quarters cited as the founder of the famous nuclear weapon freeze campaign of quite a while ago, a very successful effort to freeze nuclear weapons. She did that by writing the call to halt the nuclear arms race. And she's the founder of the Institute for Defense and Disarmament Studies, Cambridge-based nonprofit research center that she directs, publishes the Arms Control Reporter, and the IDDS database of world arms holdings, and she's written numerous articles and been on a lot of government panels, and welcome Randall Forsberg.
Hi. It's great to be with such an enthusiastic audience. In the 1980s, we had audiences like this for disarmament. And I'd like to bring some of that back. The 19th and 20th centuries have been the centuries of monopoly capitalism. As we move into the 21st century, there is a new cultural and economic phenomenon arising, monopoly militarism. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about the U.S. monopoly on the militarization of the world, the U.S. monopoly control. It starts with technology. The United States has a budget for military research and development, for developing new weapons and new military equipment for intelligence and control. The budget just for developing, not for producing, not for the soldiers and training and putting them out in the field, just for investigating, testing, engineering, and developing new weapons, is as large as the next largest entire military budget of any country in the world. That's why the United States monopolizes the development of new military technology. This was true during the Cold War. Apart from the budget of the former Soviet Union, the United States was always developing military technology that was 10 or 20 years in advance of what other countries could do. But the end of the Cold War has allowed the United States, even more than it did before, to selectively release and market pieces of military technology. We keep some of it, only we get it. A few countries, here and there, really good allies with really big rewards, going to the U.S., can get a piece or another piece. Many other countries get lower-level technology, and some cannot get any at all. Because of the economies of scale, because the U.S. military budget is about 10 times as large as the next military budget, the United States has been able to outcompete all other countries in producing and selling weapons on the global market, running other countries is effectively out of business. Right now, the European arms industries are in the process of consolidating and becoming a single, over the next few years, a single integrated arms business. I've spent a lot of time talking to people in the military, economists, and political scientists in Europe who study these matters, and I've come away with a confirmation of something I suspected, but now I've heard it from their lips. When I say, why is Europe developing a consolidated arms industry? For what reason are you producing weapons now that the Soviet Union is no more? There's no Warsaw Pact, there's no East Germany, there are no military threats of a large scale in Europe. The answer I get over and over again is, well, if we don't produce weapons, the United States will be the only country that does, and we'll have to buy them from you, and we're damned if we're going to do that. And people really mean it. So it's not a 100% monopoly. It's kind of like monopoly capitalism. It's oligopolistic, tending toward monopoly, with a few little retrenchments here and there. In addition to controlling military technology, the United States gives an enormous amount of military aid, some of it directly in the form of foreign aid, some of it in the form of subsidized purchases of weapons, some of it in the form of guaranteed loans to countries to buy weapons. Some of it, which doesn't cost all that much, a few billion, out of our $300 billion military budget, goes to train the military in other countries, for example, Indonesia. To train the military around the world in dealing with civil conflict, civil unrest, insurgency, emergencies. The United States military builds up relationships with the military around the world. We provide new technology. We undercut other countries, primarily European, Western European, our allies. We undercut their prices. We offer better offset agreements. And in all of these ways, we recruit and solicit and consolidate and solidify a monopoly relationship with the elites in countries around the world, the military elites, but also the foreign policy elites, the people who work at institutes for strategic studies, and in the foreign service, the people who develop concepts of the world and of international relations, which then drive and determine the kind of choice points that governments will make along the way in totally different issues. And as the United States recruits and solidifies this network, the people in the countries that we're working with, primarily developing countries, are kind of recruited into a classical great power view of the world in which might makes right, and that's the bottom line, and there is no humaneness, there are no democratic values. It's basically dollars and bullets that determine everything. How can the U.S. military have such power? It's because of that $300 billion military budget. You may not realize, the military budget has gone down since the end of the Cold War. If you look after you allow for inflation, it's gone down quite a lot. It's actually gone down enough to eliminate the 50% increase that Reagan brought in the 1980s. So today, we are actually back to the normal level of Cold War military spending. The level that prevailed in the United States from 1950 to 1980, except during the Korean and Vietnam War, was within, in today's dollars, was within $20 billion of $300 billion. Now, how can you have the Soviet Union disappear, the Warsaw Pact disappear? There's no threat of major war. There's no threat of another World War II, which justified $300 billion in today's dollars, $300 billion a year for 50 years. How can you have these threats disappear and the money stays the same? How did that happen? During the Cold War, the argument was made that we needed to spend this $300 billion. By the way, let's recognize that if it's still the same today and we have a growing economy, it is a smaller share of our economy. So that's one of the ways that it happened. They say, see, it used to be 6%, now it's 3%, so it's going down. Well, it's not going down, but the economy is going up. And so one of the things, the unfortunate things that happen, is that people don't pay attention to it. And I'm going to come back to people paying more attention. During the Cold War, the argument was made that we needed that higher percentage going to the military to protect democracy, to protect basic human freedoms, to protect against threats of totalitarianism. And then there was also the question of free markets and free capital and so on. What about now? Are we protecting democracy? Are we protecting freedom? Are there people we're protecting against totalitarian threats? There are not. Let me say something about the way the military see threats of war around the world. During the Cold War, the idea was that the United States would help defend the main purpose of, sorry, I need to go back a step. Another shocking fact. 95% of U.S. military spending goes to maintain armed forces and their weapons and equipment and their development and production of new weapons, all of which are intended for use overseas. 5% goes to nuclear forces, which are intended, they're kind of a psychological defense. We're going to deter someone else from sending a nuclear missile over here by threatening, once they've done that, that we'll do the same to them, even though it doesn't help us. And that way, we'll never be attacked with nuclear weapons. We have no defense against a nuclear attack, but we have this psychological deterrent. We'll scare them into not attacking us. So 5% of our budget goes to nuclear weapons to deter a nuclear attack on the United States. 95% goes to the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, all of which are intended to fight overseas. Why? Because no other country in the world can get troops over here. I remember in the 1950s, when I was 12, hearing Eisenhower talk about spending $50 billion a year, and I was thinking to myself, gee, do they think that the Chinese and the Russians are going to paratroop in, or what? And the answer is no. I went to graduate school to find out what they think. And the answer is no, they don't. They think that we're going to go over there, wherever. So how is it that we can be maintaining this $300 billion of our tax money? This is not corporate profits. This is not people going to the store and buying products they think they need. This is your and my tax dollars that we're not protesting against. How is it that this continues when there aren't any totalitarian threats and threats to democracy? How can this huge amount of money continue? The military said, we had to, during the Cold War, help Europe defend against a possible attack by the Soviet Union and also be prepared to intervene in an ideological war against communism in the Third World, for example, Korea, Vietnam, or the Russian counterpart, Afghanistan. We had to be able to fight 1.5 World War IIs, one in Europe and a half someplace else in the world. Well, the one in Europe has gone away. What about the half someplace else in the world? Who are the enemies that the military see today? 4 or 5 countries? I'll tell you who they are. North Korea, China, Iraq, and Syria. Those are all of the enemies, all of the potential military opponents of the United States today. In the future, we might be able to add Iran. Now, that's like 10, 20, 30 years because they only have a couple of hundred tanks. They basically don't have any military in Iran. They don't tell you that. They tell you it's a terrible country which supports terrorism. They didn't mention that there's no military forces there. What about the other ones? North Korea and Syria, Iraq? These are countries with a population of a few tens of millions of people, extremely poor, impoverished, sanctioned in the case of Iraq. And what about China? Well, China does have a large army. Some of their internal security forces train with wooden rifles because they don't have enough rifles to go around. They've tried to make up for what they don't have in money, equipment, capital, advanced technology with numbers. The majority of the combat aircraft in the Chinese Air Force, which is about the same size as the U.S. combat aircraft, about the same number, the majority of the planes are Chinese-made copies of Russian MiG-19s, which were designed in 1953. Washington military analyst told me that the way they count these when they do their war games is on a 15-to-1 ratio. So there, in fact, there is no country, half of the U.S. conventional military forces conducted a rout in Iraq, not a war. Their goal today is to win any, they don't call them wars anymore, to win any military encounter without a single casualty, from the air, from a distance. They did that almost. In Iraq, they not only want to win without a casualty, they want to win in a few weeks. And they, in fact, virtually did that in Iraq, in a country which at the time had armed forces which were then twice as powerful as any third world country has today. So threats? What does it say if you look at their own current justifications? How do they describe what they think they're defending against? Well, the most recent annual report of the Secretary of Defense says, why are we developing a new anti-ballistic missile system in case China or Iran or Iraq or India develops longer-range ballistic missiles down the road? Why are we developing this? Because we want to have total, these are literally the words in the report, freedom of action, defined as freedom from attack, freedom to attack. That's the goal of military technology development in the United States today. In other words, we don't have an enemy. There is no foreseeable enemy. China is acquiring new weapons and technology slowly. China has a goal of becoming a military superpower by the year 2050. They do long-term planning there. In the meantime, the United States has not adopted a policy of doing all that we can to prevent the proliferation of missiles, of nuclear weapons, and chemical and biological weapons, by leading the way for arms control, by promoting equitable agreements, by holding up our end of the non-proliferation treaty, by being willing to make some quid pro quos. We won't do this if you won't do that. The U.S. position is we're going to do what we feel like because we can, and we don't give a damn what you do. Go ahead, do it. That has been the U.S. policy under a liberal democratic administration for the last 10 years. The point I want to make here is that not so much that this military, this enormous military that can do anything it wants to anywhere, or at least has that as a goal, has as its main function being able to intervene around the world to support one political, economic regime or government or system over another should the need arise, although that's true. In my view, the U.S. military is a dinosaur. It's a relic of an earlier era. It's overkill, like nuclear overkill. Now we have non-nuclear overkill. We're paying this enormous tax on our system, leaching out of the economy the surplus product, the resources, the energy, this $300 billion a year that could be put to productive, useful human ends. In order to maintain a global power system with a 19th century model, a hierarchical system in which might makes right, power devolves from the top by kind of noblesse oblige to the people. We decide which governments and which countries and which systems will get some freedom of action and which ones won't. Which ones will get a few breaks and which ones won't. I am winding up. This military system is an invisible and insidious monopoly, precisely because people don't know these facts. It's not in your supermarket. It's not on your living room television. It's not in your daily paper. It's not in your lives at all. And so there is no protest. There is no objection. And yet it's like the skeleton or maybe a suit of armor. It's kind of the binding structure of the international system that keeps people around the world marching lockstep forward in an archaic set of values instead of looking at human needs. This is a system that can be changed. but it can only be changed from the bottom up. It can only be changed when people refuse to tolerate this any longer. Let me close giving you one extraordinary example, and I also want to ask you to look for this on your way out. It's a proposal for global action to prevent war, to dismantle this system. The example I want to give you is concerns the way the UN works under U.S. monopoly militarism. At the time when the decision was being made in the Security Council to give the United States permission to intervene in Iraq, not just to intervene, but to choose the date and the manner and to run the war, at the time when the vote was about to be taken in the Security Council, the U.S. ambassador did a little private polling and found out, okay, China would abstain, and I think Cuba or Yemen or somebody else was going to abstain, and most of the other countries on the 15-member council were going to vote in favor, but two were planning to abstain that were just regular countries, not like China. They were regular U.S. subordinates, one in the Pacific, and the other was Venezuela. This was told by a diplomat at the UN, a story told to me privately. So George Bush called the head of the Venezuelan government and said, you know, hello, Mike, your ambassador up here is sort of a loose cannon. He says he's going to abstain from this vote. And the president of Venezuela said, no, he's not a loose cannon. That's our position. We're going to abstain. So Bush said, well, I don't think that's such a good idea. You know, I hope you'll change your mind. And the next week, customs officials were unable to clear the airlifted shipments of flowers, which represent a major source of income to Venezuela, which sat on the ground and rotted in the plains. And until the president heard that Venezuela was going to vote in favor. So this is the global economy and global monopoly militarism working upside down. We have the flowers wilting in front of the guns. Thank you.
Well, you've been with us for almost 7 hours now, I want to point out. And most of us are still together. And we have one more speaker, and he's the right man to wrap it up, I think. But before I introduce Andy Kimbrell, I want to mention that there are some people who had tickets for the video feed rooms that we allowed into fill up some seats that we had upstairs because the technical equipment wasn't working right earlier. For tonight's session that starts at 6 o'clock, you'll have to please go back into that room. It is working now, and we expect to have a full house starting at 6 o'clock. Now, our last speaker of the day to wrap up this panel on technology, globalization, the role of military and communications technology. We have Andy Kimbrell. He's probably the number one public interest attorney in the United States battling on biotechnology. He's won numerous lawsuits in the area of corporate patenting of plant, animal, and human life. He's the founder of the Center for Technology Assessment here in Washington, and the Center for Food Safety, which has been the leading battler against the organic standards that the United States wanted to impose and toward a set of standards that would not include biotechnology and sludge. He's written numerous books and articles. His best-known books are The Human Body Shop and The Masculine Mystique. He's a former director of the Foundation of Economic Trends, where many of his famous lawsuits took place. And he's a director of the IFG as well. Here's Andy Kimbrell. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Jerry, not just for that introduction, but for also being my mentor and my guide and my inspiration, and not just me, countless others in this fight, this wonderful fight against globalization. You know, when Jerry got me into it, you know, it seemed monolithic. It seemed like it couldn't be defeated, one of those great quixotic battles that so many of us spent so much of our lives trying to fight. Some of us gone gray in those battles. And it is so terrific now to see that, and you were right all along, they can be challenged and they can be defeated. Maybe I say they will be defeated. You know, the rhetoric of the Clinton administration and virtually all the globalization proponents is, you've heard it all, right? Freedom, open borders, liberation, fostering democracy. Well, this panel today is very, very close to my heart because you see, from the extraordinary speeches and talks and presentations by these people, that this is a complete lie. That the reality is far, far different. Behind that rhetoric actually lies an extraordinary corporate and government technological and technocratical infrastructure of virtual total control. Control of our communities, societies, individuals, traditions, even the genes of our bodies. You've seen where a handful of corporations are running the entire media, resulting in that virtually majority of the world's population at this point succumbing to that numbing of the monoculture of the mind that Vandana Shiva talks about. We've seen our entire military retooling so it can fight 3 to 5 police actions around the globe. We all know what that means. One of them may occur this weekend. Jerry talked about the extraordinary power that computers allow this globalization system. I don't know how many people heard about the Echelon. People know about the Echelon program, multi-governmental program using computer technology to analyze every message, right? Every electronic message transferred on Earth at all times. Not science fiction, actual fact happening today. So while we all enjoy the power we have over computers, we cannot forget, as Jerry reminded us, that this power gives exponentially more power to the corporations than it does to us. We all, of course, know about these new technocratic structures that have usurped democracy around the world, including this country, those Bretton Woods monsters that we're here to confront, challenge, and stop. A couple things we didn't mention that I think are kind of interesting. I don't know how many people are familiar with the new satellite technology, another gift to the military-industrial establishment that Steve and Randy did such a great job talking about. We now have virtual, complete mapping of the world through satellites at all times, 24 hours a day, 1 meter resolution, right? 3 feet. Now several corporations are doing it. I talked to one guy and said, you know, we used to be able to tell whether you had a pool. We can now tell what you're wearing in your pool. Maybe some of the most chilling control and something I deal with on a daily basis is the new ability of these technologies to mix, match, and change the very genetic makeup of the entire living kingdom. To search the world for valuable genetic material, to steal it, to patent it, and to change the very physiology of the microbes, plants, animals, and yes, humans, the world to fit their profit research needs. Total control, from the skies to the gene. That's what they're about. That's what they do. It's got nothing to do with freedom. It's got nothing to do with democracy. It's got nothing to do with liberation. They're managers. They're managers in their souls. They're managers in their mind. And that's what they want to do, is manage and control. That's all they want to do. So let's call it what it is. Now, what do the World Bank and IMF have to do with all this? They're the pushers of this technological invasion, right? They're the financial viruses that infect the rest of the world so this control can happen. You know, if you look at what they actually finance, it becomes very, very clear what they're about. Over the last 20 years, about 50% of IMF and World Bank investment has involved either energy, systems, transportation systems, or new industrial agricultural systems. Right? Ideas to go into countries around the world, destroy their native and indigenous agricultural systems, completely alter their social relationships, completely reallocate their resources so they'll fit monolithic industrial energy, transportation, and food production systems. The World Bank lists as its number one job technology transfer. Get on the IMF website, go ahead and do it. We know they're just basically the surveillance arm of the World Bank, right? But you know what they say their number one job is too? Technology transfer. That's what we're all about. That's what we're here to do. And by the way, you know the number one good that's sold in this new global market? Largest single component study. IPS just came out with a study. The automobile. Automobile parts. Any infrastructure that allows for the automobile. Number one. Of course, it's also number one cause of global warming. Robert Graves, the poet, wonderful poet, said he'd become a Catholic when the Pope issued an encyclical against the combustion engine. Unfortunately, he'd still be waiting. But all this brings up, I think, something which for me is very, very important. You know, I come from an old left-wing New York family, and most of my relatives spent most of their lives in the union movement, organizing. And I was brought up pretty early to know that the great struggle of the world was ownership of the means of production, right? But all this technology that the last few centuries have given us, and the big battle is who's going to own it? Who's going to get the profits? Over the last 20 years, I've learned a different lesson, actually. Not that that is not a terribly important battle, and not that many brave women and men fought and died fighting that battle. But I think we miss something on the way. We miss something that this globalization process points out. This total control points out. While we were worried about the politics of the ownership of the means of production, we forgot about the politics of the means of production themselves. We forgot that technology has a politics, that technology is legislation, that technology is a political act. One of the most pernicious habits of thought, pieces of propaganda we hear all the time is technology is neutral. Well, I'm here to tell you technology is never neutral. Technology always represents power, power over something, from the hammer to the nuclear bomb. It represents power. And the question is that power appropriate? And what changes does that power make occur wherever that technology goes? Let me give you an example. Okay? Let's talk about the conservatives' favorite, nuclear power. What do you need for a nuclear power plant? Here the World Bank, and it's done this often, is going to loan. It's an investment bank, that's all it really does, right? It's going to loan millions, billions of dollars for nuclear power plants. It's done this all over the world. Several in Brazil alone. What do you get along with a nuclear power plant? Is it a neutral technology? What do you need to build it? A lot of water. That's right. What else you need? Lots of uranium. Military elite, you bet. What else?
A lot of money.
A lot of money. Brings us right back to our friends at the World Bank, doesn't it? It has to be a huge capital investment. You got to get it from somewhere. What else? Right, scientific elite, you need your engineers. Yeah, you got some kind of, you got to waste, get rid of the waste somehow. Barry Common always used to say building a nuclear power plant was like building a home without a bathroom. And people are going to argue forever about where that stuff's going to go. And the U.S. Congress is still arguing, by the way. What else do you need? Right. This is what our conservative friends say, our right-wing friends, I should say, are always saying, well, listen, we've got we love this technology, but we hate bureaucracy. You've got some major cognitive dissonance there, babe. Well, that helps too. Well, that goes with the money. What you got here is huge bureaucracies, right? You need a bureaucracy for safety. You need a bureaucracy to disseminate this huge amount of information, of energy to millions of people, right? It's a totally inappropriate technology, very dangerous. Someone said it's like cutting butter with a chainsaw, because all it really does is boil water. So when you get a nuclear power plant, what kind of society are you going to get? Let's count it up. One that requires huge capital investments, exhausts its resources. You have a military elite. You have a scientific elite. You have massive bureaucracies, right, for safety, for energy dissemination. You've got a technocratized, technologized, elitist society. And what about the citizen? All right? What about you and me? Now, we're sitting here. Okay, let's all get together on a one huge conference call. It's called Washington Power. And we say, you know what? We've taken a vote. We all oppose nuclear power. We want to make absolutely certain that the energy that's coming into this building during this very important meeting is not coming from Calvert Cliffs nuclear power plant. So stop it right now. What would the response be? Probably massive laughter. I just got this call. You can't believe. Right? Because not only does this impose a technological and totalitarian infrastructure in a society dominated by military elites, scientific elites, and bureaucracies, it completely disempowers the citizen. You have no power. Ethics 01, can you take responsibility for this technology? No. Can it be responsive to you? No. And when you build your entire society out of these technologies, it's ludicrous to call yourself a democracy because you have a complete totalitarian infrastructure. You say, well, I'm not so sure of that. Well, go to work. Because what does this do to work? The vast majority of Americans don't work in a democracy. They work in a totalitarian state. Whether it's a corporation, whether it's a bureaucracy, they work in a totalitarian state. Not that we're not fighting for workplace democracy, as we should. Let's get real about that. The second thing it does, and Jerry mentioned this, and I was thinking about this as he was talking, it cocoons us, right? This technological milieu that we've created in this infrastructure, it turns us into cocoons. Look at that automobile. We're totally cocooned in an artificial environment. You know, I walk my dog at night, and I look in, and there's no one's talking on the streets. No one's communicating like that even when I was a kid. Everybody else sees little blue lights flashing through the windows? Everyone's in front of some screen or another. Kids aren't talking to their parents. Why talk to them anyway? Because generations don't understand this technology. It's cocooned us, and that cocooning is very, very dangerous. Right? It turns us into the perfect soft managerial state because we are so cocooned into these technologies that are given to us, these conveniences of which we have no control, that we don't even talk to each other. The greatest threat to the First Amendment in the United States, I'm telling you this right now, is the television and the computer. You can forget everything else. They are stopping more speech, more communication than anything else you could possibly imagine. And in these cocoons, I think the tragedy I see as I get older is how they've made us autistic. They've made a society autistic to the natural world and to the terrible tragedies that things like globalization cause socially. And Washington is a great town to see it for those of you who are visiting. Watch these people walking down the street. They are totally autistic to the suffering they're causing to the natural world, to the crimes that they are creating around the world. Pardon? I can't hear you. They are cut off by their cocooning. They're completely cut off from any appreciation of the natural world and from an empathy with the people they're with. And there is a reason for that. There's a reason that they are cut off. It was mentioned a little bit before, but I think, you know, we are not only fighting a new force in society that's destroying our democracy through technology, and this is this technocratic infrastructure, we're fighting an ideology. They do have an ideology. And it's the ideology they're imposing to their structural adjustment programs, ideology they're opposing through their loans, and yes, an ideology that they will end up and are enforcing through the new military. It's the cult of efficiency. Get on those websites. I did last week. The World Bank, IMF. There's about 50 mentions of efficiency. All we're trying to do is to make local economies more efficient. That's all we're trying to do. You know, when I was doing research on my book on genetic engineering, I went to the USDA. They let me in because this is before I sued them. And I was investigating a really horrible experiment. They were taking human genes. Dr. Vern Purcell, actually, right up here in Beltsville, Maryland, was taking human genes, putting in the permanent genetic code of cows. He wanted to create a super cow. Some guy named Ralph Brinster had done this at the University of Pennsylvania in 1982. He'd taken human genes and he put them into a mouse and created a super mouse, a really huge mouse. And they had the front cover of Science magazine and Nature magazine. You saw this huge mouse and its sibling, little mouse. The huge mouse had the human gene in every cell of its body. Little mouse didn't have the cell. It was a wonder. A few months passed and people asked an important question: what good is a really huge mouse? Outside of Halloween or a couple of, perhaps. So Purcell got the idea, I'm going to create a really huge pig the same way. I went up and saw it, pig 6707, I describe it in the book. And he couldn't stand up. He was bow-legged, he was arthritic. The picture I took of it, I sent it to a slide, he had to put him up against a plywood board because he couldn't stand up. It was a very tragic creature. And I asked Dr. Purcell, what are you trying to do here? He said, I'm trying to make the pig more efficient. This writ large is what the World Bank does. Now, this cult of efficiency, if I were to tell you, which is true, that I have two teenage children, a daughter and a son, and I treat them very efficiently, we all know what efficiency is, right? Maximum output for minimum input in minimum time. Right? Okay, that's how I treat my kids. Right? Maximum input of, minimum input of food and affection for a maximum output of good grades. Promise by my daughter that she will not slam doors. Right? From my pet, my beloved dogs. Treat them efficiently. They don't do any work. I mean, they're like pee on rugs and eat baseball gloves. What about your friends? Treat your friends efficiently. 2 a.m. call. Andy, I can't believe it. Bob left me. Sorry, inefficient phone call. I have a speech to give tomorrow. Check off, inefficient friend. Do we treat anything we truly care about on an efficiency basis? Absolutely not. And yet here we have the World Bank, the IMF, saying we should treat every society, every individual, the entire natural world solely based on efficiency. That is pathological. Efficiency is the right logic for machines. Right? This is this politics of technology. It's not the right logic for human thing or any living thing. There's one other piece of this ideology which is important for us to remember, and that's marketism. Right? We don't often talk about this. You can go through whole conferences and the C word, capitalism, is not often mentioned. But let's face it, right? That's their ideology. Marketism, free markets. It's a religion. We've talked, some of the prophets have been spoken about before. Milton Friedman, Maynard Keynes. Marketism. And marketism is based on the concept of competition. Now, we know it doesn't really happen. But what about competition? Let's run that through a little test. What if I had my kids compete and said, whoever gets better grades stays in the house? Other one, you're gone. Sorry? It's the only efficient thing we can do. It's how the market works, baby. Pathological, right? You certainly wouldn't go out with, you know, for a beer with me based on that, would you? All right, this guy is sick. That's exactly the logic of the World Bank, IMF, WTO, and our entire world market system. Winners and losers. We're going to be the winners, says President Clinton. They're going to be the losers. Losers means starvation, right? Environmental destruction, every catastrophe you can imagine. Competition is the ethic of isolation. It is the destruction of cooperation, the destruction of empathy. Again, a pathological ethic by which to have the basis of an entire world system. Efficiency, competition. That's their ideology. We have to balance efficiency with empathy. Dare we say the word love? And we have to balance competition with cooperation. Every evolutionary biologist will tell you the species only survive, not through competition, Pache, social Darwinist, but through cooperation. That was nice. I like that. Let me mention one more thing, because you're going to get hit with it just like I get hit with it all the time. I'll finish up with this. They'll say, that's all great, Andy, but we've got to make progress. Love you, guy, but we've got to make progress. President Clinton said at the end of his last State of the Union speech, we all are united in one belief in this country, and I knew he was going to say God. I was wrong. He said, we all still believe in progress. Well, progress is an incomplete sentence. Don't you dare, any of us dare, let anybody ever use that word without having them finish that sentence. Progress towards what? Genetic engineering, satellites, this new defense, everything you've heard about today, which is the new technologies, is not progress. It is not the world, the future vision any of us want to see. Any of us want to see. You know what? Millions of people know that. You know, the great thing about saying freeze, which Randy was so great and so many others in fighting and starting, was they had the courage to say no to a technology. Over the last 30 or 40 years, many people have said, we're saying no to industrial food. We're saying no to GE Foods. And by the way, FDA right now is asking for your opinion. Absolutely no to GE Foods. Millions of people are saying no to television. We're not going to be part of the grid. We have to have the courage to say no. That's the thing we've learned from these movements. You know, restrict your consumption. I think people are so frustrated by meaningless work, and that's the only thing they can think of doing. 36 years ago, a teach-in very similar to this in Berkeley, Mario Savio, who died a couple years ago, said something which I think is so apt for this whole new technological politics, which I hope I've convinced you is what we're really fighting here, and against the technological pushers, IMF and World Bank. He said this: there's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. You've got to put your bodies on the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, and the whole apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, and everyone is free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. Amen, Mario.